I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With 22 days left in office, President Trump is closer to seeing what could be the first veto override of his presidency. Last night, over 100 Republicans in the House joined Democrats in voting to override the president's veto of an annual defense policy bill, a bill that almost routinely passes, but which Trump rejected in part because it doesn't do enough to stop what he claims is social media bias against conservatives. There's also some interesting politics developing over the president's late demand last week that coronavirus relief checks be increased from $600 to $2,000. Let's bring in NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, who's watching all of this. And Kelsey, you'd have to say the House handed the president a stinging defeat on the defense bill. Was that expected? And what do you read into it?
Well, we did expect that the House was going to easily vote to overturn the president's veto, in part because the Defense Authorization Act is one of the most bipartisan things that Congress does every single year. In fact, it is so bipartisan that it has passed with huge majorities for the past 59 years. There are very few things that you can say that about. And in part, that's because it's an authorizing bill that just says that, you know, that Congress is prepared to support the spending and the policies necessary to support the armed forces. And that is, generally speaking, a very popular position in Congress. The fact that the president decided to veto this was the thing that was a surprise in some ways, because he was starting a fight over something that is completely unrelated to the work of the committee that writes that authorization bill. So even most Republicans said that they didn't understand why this was in any way related, and they were unwilling to, you know, to blow up something that is so very important to the core of the way Congress operates over a fight that the president chose to pick that was, like I said, unrelated.
Yeah. Well, on Twitter this morning, President Trump called unnamed Republicans weak and tired for allowing the defense bill to pass. What does Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell say, because it's heading his way?
Well, we have heard very, very, very little from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We do know that the defense bill will come up on the floor. We don't know exactly what the timing will be. There are some factors that are getting in the way of when that might happen. But we really do expect that there will be a large Republican vote to overturn the veto there as well, meaning that the veto will not stand.
Well, the factors. Let's look at this, because last night conservatives voted with House Democrats to pass that $2,000 coronavirus relief check. So, you know, does this leave McConnell in a bind?
It's certainly an interesting situation, and one that I am watching extremely closely. So the bill to extend the existing relief checks that were passed as part of the last coronavirus relief package, it passed on this sped up kind of process, and it passed with the bare minimum of votes needed to speed it through to a vote in the Senate. Now, that was 2/3 of the House voted for that bill. Now, that is pretty significant to have a vote, that basically says that they're going to go back on something that was negotiated between the president, Republican leadership, and Democratic leadership. It is a confusing moment in so many ways, because the president essentially undercut all of his Republican allies in Congress and his own negotiators in the White House. So now Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has to decide if he's going to allow a vote on it. And up until today, it seemed like there wasn't quite the right pressure to make McConnell do that. But we've seen in the past couple of hours, the two senators from Georgia, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, who are up in a runoff election next week, said they would support these checks. So, you know, McConnell is looking to protect them because their seats are really what decide the balance of power in the Senate. So this is one of the more complicated political moments that I've seen in quite some time, in a year full of complicated political moments.
Well, let's add some more, shall we? I mean, by the way, you mentioned the Republican candidates in Georgia. They're getting hammered by the Democrats in those races who are supporting the $2,000 check. But then you also have Senator Bernie Sanders now threatening to filibuster a vote on the defense bill unless there is a vote on the $2,000 relief checks. What's likely to happen here?
Well, so the power that Senator Sanders has here is to slow things down, not to stop anything, really. So what he's doing would essentially mean that they would push off the vote to override the veto until New Year's Day, though we're hearing apparently McConnell is on the floor saying that as we speak, he's on the floor saying that the vote will still happen. Now, this is one of those very Senate moments where they are kind of figuring things out on the fly because, you know, the Senate is a place where individual senators have the power to slow things down. But at the end, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is the one who controls the floor. And in this case, he is saying the override vote will be tomorrow.
Well, Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional correspondent, this means that we'll be updating this story as we go along this day. So we'll be calling you back to see what happened. Kelsey, real quick, what is the thinking of Mike Pence, vice president and Senate president, will be there on January 6th to certify the Electoral College vote?
We have not heard any updates on the vice president's plans. I think that we are going to be watching the certification very closely as that comes up next week.
Kelsey Snell, thank you so much.
Well, as Kelsey Snell alluded to, much of what's happening in Washington is with an eye on Georgia. The state is just 1 week away from those crucial Senate runoffs, two highly contested races that will decide which party controls the Senate. Over 2 million people in Georgia have already voted. Hundreds of millions of fundraising dollars are flowing into the Peach State. And President Trump and President-elect Biden are using their influence to tip the balance of those races. Joining us now to break all of this down is Emil Moffitt with member station WABE in Atlanta. Emil, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tanya. Good to be here.
Yeah, so it's been over a month since the traditional Republican stronghold flipped in the presidential election. Let's start with the early voting turnout. What areas are leading in turnout so far, and what can we learn from that?
As you mentioned, more than 2 million. It's now at 2.3 million votes have already been cast, either early votes or vote by mail. We have seen strong turnout in rural areas, but we're also seeing big increases in heavily Democratic counties in and around Atlanta and Fulton and DeKalb County. More than 500,000 votes have been cast in those two Democratic strongholds that went very heavily for Joe Biden back in November.
John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, the Democratic challengers, have each raised over $100 million. Ossoff's fundraising actually broke records for the highest amount ever raised for a Senate candidate. How have they been able to secure such vast funds, and how are they spending it?
There's been a lot of momentum from Joe Biden's victory in the state in November. Democrats now believing that they do have a voice and they do have a chance to change the power balance in Washington. And so that has really boosted the fundraising efforts of John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, not only from in Georgia, but around the country as well. Ossoff says he's relied a lot on smaller donations. He says about 97% of his donors have given $200 or less. And they're spending it a lot on television advertising. They're spending on text and mailers. And if you're in Georgia, you are no doubt, if you're a voter in Georgia, you're no doubt hearing about this election pretty much nonstop.
Oh, I can imagine. Give us a sense of how much the Republican incumbents, Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, how much have they raised?
Yeah, by comparison, they have not raised as much as their Democratic counterparts. The latest figures that we're seeing show about $68 million for David Perdue since mid-October and about $64 million for Loeffler. So combined, about $40 million less than their Democratic rivals.
But that's not all the money that actually is going into this race. Outside groups won't have to disclose the majority of their spending until well after the race. Why is that?
Well, the filing deadlines for a lot of these outside groups are not until later in the cycle. So it'll be after the election maybe early February before we know exactly what has been outspent. We mentioned that the Democrat candidates had outraised the Republican candidates themselves. But when we look at the outside money that's been spent from outside groups, conservative outside groups have spent more than $130 million more than progressive groups. So we're seeing that kind of counterbalance from the candidates to the outside groups.
A lot of the Democrats' success in this presidential election that just passed was owed on the ground for on the ground and get out the vote groups where Black leaders like Stacey Abrams, among others, mobilized voters. Are we seeing similar pushes this time around? And what lessons are there possibly to learn for Democrats?
We are. We're seeing, you know, Fair Fight, the New Georgia Project, some of these prominent groups that were involved in the November election trying to get that turnout and did turn out voters in large numbers for Democrats. We're seeing the same type of efforts, even stepped up efforts to try to reach people either through door knocking, through the mail, through text and phone calls. So we are seeing a lot of a continuation of what we saw in November, not only from progressive groups and Democrats, but also on the Republican side as well, as trying to get the vote out and get as many people to the polls as possible. And we're starting to see that. We don't normally see this type of continued enthusiasm and turnout for a runoff election, but we are definitely seeing that in Georgia here in this race.
Yeah, I have less than 30 seconds with you, but Trump and Biden, they're wielding their influence in these runoffs.
They are. Both have visited since the presidential election. Donald Trump is scheduled to be back in Georgia Monday, the day before the election. But he's kind of complicated things for his two candidates, not only with his continued vociferation of what happened in November, but also with some of his last-minute protests over the spending and stimulus plans.
WABE's Emil Moffitt, as always, thank you so much.
Throughout this pandemic, we've been touching down around the world. Today, Brazil, Germany, and South Korea. More than 191,000 people have died from COVID-19 in Brazil, where President Jair Bolsonaro downplayed the virus even after testing positive. Germany's death toll just passed 30,000, and South Korea has picked up the more contagious variant of the virus that first was seen in the UK. So let's check in with three NPR reporters. Anthony Kuhn is in Seoul, South Korea. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Robin.
Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Robin.
And Philip Reeves is in Rio. Phil, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
I feel like you guys take us to places. So let's do that now. And Phil, let's go to Brazil. Second highest COVID death toll in the world. How would you characterize this moment in the pandemic?
I would characterize it as very worrying. Some Brazilian cities are saying they've again run out of or are running out of intensive care beds. New Year is a very big deal here in Brazil, and medical experts are really worried that these festivities will produce a fresh surge. This city where I am now, Rio de Janeiro, has announced a bunch of measures to stop crowds holding parties on Copacabana Beach. Normally, a couple of million people hit the beach to celebrate the turn of the year, but this year, public transport's banned from entering the area, roads are going to be blocked off. But we don't know if it's going to work, because in the last couple of days, local authorities in several parts of Brazil have said they're reintroducing restrictions to stop the virus spreading, for example, closing all but essential businesses. But they've later cancelled these measures because crowds took to the streets to protest.
Yeah. So you have maybe an even bigger concern. I mean, having seen that scene on the beach there, it is just unbelievable. It's several times Times Square. So there's a concern there. But it's not just Brazil. COVID-19 is the leading cause of death in Peru, Chile, Ecuador. Is there something that ties these countries together when it comes to the toll?
Well, yeah. I mean, at one point, Peru, even though it locked down early, had the highest death rate per capita from COVID pretty much in the world. Chile has also had one of the worst outbreaks in Latin America. And you'll probably remember in Ecuador in April, the situation got completely out of hand in the city of Guayaquil, where bodies wound up being dumped in the streets because hospitals and undertakers were just overwhelmed. Now, look, death and infections are well down from peak levels in all these countries, all three of them, but no one's out of the woods. Ecuador just yesterday said the virus is still in full swing. But these three nations, like the entire region, all of Latin America, now face, you know, several huge challenges. One is how to recover their economies. These have taken a huge hit. I mean, Peru's seen the highest, the biggest drop in GDP in a century. And two, how to avoid another surge in the pandemic. Chile has, much to the envy of its neighbors, launched a vaccine program for frontline health workers. But the other two countries, Peru and Ecuador, haven't reached that point yet.
Philip Reeves there in Rio. You stand by. I want to now bring in Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Rob, in a two-month period, Germany went from around 150 COVID deaths a day to around 1,000. Huge jump. Why?
Yeah, well, back in the autumn, in Germany's second wave, the virus was mostly spread through young people in Germany, while, whether it's at schools or among young adults who are basically ignoring social distancing and going out with each other to bars and restaurants. As a result, we saw infections go up, but the number of deaths remained low until about a month ago at the beginning of the holiday season here in Germany. And that's because the virus is now being spread among an older, less healthy demographic in the population.
And what's the reason?
Well, I don't think health authorities fully have an understanding of that, but they think that it's possible that it's just the holiday season itself that is bringing Germans outside, which is normal among, you know, Germans around this time of year. Usually have Christmas markets, but of course they're all closed. And, you know, the reason we're now in a second lockdown is because many Germans were not following the restrictions of the first lockdown. You know, Phil just talked about Copacabana Beach. Here in Germany, you've got crowds of people up until a couple weeks ago crowding around Glühwein stands that were run by restaurants that needed extra money because the Christmas markets were closed. So people wanted their Glühwein.
Glühwein?
Yeah, it's a typical drink here in Germany around Christmas time. But now all of those stands are shut down because of the second lockdown. But Germans continue to flout the rules. Parts of Germany have had a lot of snow recently, and the autobahns in the last couple of days have been jammed with people who want to go sledding and play in the snow. So sledding hills are packed with people, and police are issuing fines. One city took to Facebook to order people not to come to their city to see the snow because there were simply too many tourists at a time when none of this should be allowed.
Huh? Don't come. That's interesting. Is Germany seeing the new variant of the coronavirus?
Yeah, a case of the new variant here in Germany was reported at the Frankfurt airport this past weekend. It was a woman who was tested by German authorities after arriving from London. And this prompted health authorities to go back and check old samples from people who have had the virus. And they found the new variant in at least two samples from people who had the virus before. And it shows that the new variant seems to have been present in Germany since November.
Yeah. Well, Rob Schmitz is there in Berlin, in Germany. And Rob, you hold on now. I want to turn to Anthony Kuhn in Seoul. And Anthony, South Korea got a lot of credit for the way it responded to the pandemic when it first started, which doesn't that seem like a long time ago, but it was less than a year. And as the year ends, we know South Korea has now a third wave. What happened?
Well, as you say, initially, politicians and health experts say this is how a country prepares for and aggressively tackles a virus with testing and contact tracing. And they did successfully flatten two big infection curves in February and August. But now they're facing a lot of criticism that they haven't tackled a third wave, which began last month with quite the same zeal because they're concerned about the economy. Now, over the past week, we've seen record high case numbers of over 1,000. And you're going to hear that and you're going to say that's nothing. And it's true that they have the second lowest rate behind New Zealand of the big developed economies. But as the South Korean government itself is warning, the healthcare system is now under considerable stress. They're setting new records. They're seeing higher mortality rates. And some patients have even died at home while waiting for hospital beds to become available.
And so, you know, be more specific, because there were more specifics that South Korea was doing to help people, you know, the testing and everything. What are some of the deeper reasons? What are people doing that's helping the spread? Is it churches? What is it?
Right. Well, the first two waves of infections were, in fact, focused on churches or a particular city. And these were big clusters of infections, which were easier to trace and to isolate. But this third wave is now mostly small-scale community transmissions among friends, among family, and increasingly among elderly nursing home residents. And this is why the critics are saying that tougher measures must be taken. And to a certain degree, people let their guard down, I think. I mean, after the two peaks were suppressed and restrictions were eased, it kind of felt like life was getting back to normal here. But in fact, what was happening was that a lot of asymptomatic cases and undetected transmissions were going on, and they've exploded into this third wave. And like anywhere else, people have just become a bit numb and burned out and indifferent.
It's interesting, because what we're hearing from all three of you is that people are people everywhere, and they're all kind of doing the same things, like having family gatherings on the holidays, that are leading to these spikes. And just briefly, the AP is reporting today the U.S. has started vaccinating its troops in South Korea. Are people in South Korea getting vaccines?
That's right. Today, the U.S. troops in South Korea and Japan started getting vaccinations. But the first South Koreans who are not working with the U.S. military will probably not start getting vaccinated until February. And the government's getting some heat for this. They say this is not a race to see who gets the first shots. But in fact, South Korean people, polls show, are actually more concerned about speed than safety.
Yeah. Anthony Kuhn there in Seoul, South Korea. But quick question to each of you about vaccinations. Rob Schmitz, Germany started vaccinating, you know, people over the weekend as part of the EU's right. vaccination program. So who's getting them first in Germany?
Those who live and work at nursing homes, people who work at hospitals, and after that, those who have pre-existing conditions that would make them more vulnerable to the virus.
And Phil Reeves there in Rio. Vaccinations have not started in Brazil. Is there a plan for who would be first?
Well, the government says it does have a plan. Details are so far very vague. Brazilian health regulators actually haven't yet approved a vaccine, and the country is extremely proud of its history of holding successful mass vaccination programs, and it's now finding itself lagging behind a lot of countries, including several in the neighborhood. I mean, Argentina today is starting a vaccination program. So Bolsonaro's been backing a vaccine developed by AstraZeneca with Oxford University, and officials are saying this will be submitted for approval in the middle of next month, and then everyone will have access to it, and if approved, vaccination can begin soon after that. But this issue has become incredibly politicized here. Bolsonaro's great rival, as the governor of the country's most populous state, Sao Paulo, is promoting the Chinese-made CoronaVac and already has a lot of doses ready to roll. And Bolsonaro seized on this as an opportunity for China bashing, criticizing the vaccine, criticizing the governor. And when tests of CoronaVac were briefly suspended a while back, he called that a personal victory.
That's Phil Reeves in Brazil. We also spoke with Rob Schmitz in Germany, Anthony Kuhn in South Korea. I want to thank all three of you for your terrific reporting the whole past year throughout the pandemic and other news, and for being with us here today. And I wish you a much happier new year, at least when it comes to this pandemic coming up. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Thanks, Robin.
In any major city, you see it. People living on the sidewalks with no home to go to, and often a loyal dog cuddled next to them. A group of volunteers and academics have now found that keeping these pets healthy may be a way of keeping their owners healthy, too. Joanne Silberner of Seattle reports.
Ask a homeless person about their pet, and you might hear something like this.
Yay, Rowan!
Rowan is a 4-year-old chocolate lab who has been part of Amanda Richards' life for the last 3.5 years. 2 of those years were spent on the streets of Seattle.
You have to be constantly cognizant of your environment. Is there danger? But some of that is relieved when you have someone or an animal watching your back.
Richard had been stunned to find herself homeless after emotional trauma and a brain injury. She now has a home. When she didn't, Rowan was her lifeline, an antidote to the tension of life on the streets.
Rowan is my best friend. She's there through it all.
Richard now volunteers at a unique twice-a-month clinic called One Health. It's run by the University of Washington, Washington State University, and Neighbor Care Health in downtown Seattle. The free clinic is the brainchild of the dean of the WSU Vet School and Peter Rabinowitz, who's a physician and a professor at the University of Washington.
So a lot of times people come and they say, I need care for my animal because I know my animal needs care. And they may not emphasize right at the beginning that they actually could use some health care themselves.
Clients at the clinic come for their pets' problems, and they might just share those same problems. A dog may have a rash from sleeping in a wet tent.
And by finding the problem in the animal, you can then suspect that maybe the person has the same problem and you can provide sort of joint treatment. And ideally, pick up that there's an environmental problem that needs to be dealt with as well.
Patients, that is, pets and their people, are greeted by a volunteer, usually a medical student who gets a little bit of the pet's history and may ask if people would like some medical care, as long as they're there already. Then on to the veterinarian. Today, it's Katie Kuhl. She's an instructor with Washington State University. She sees a lot at the clinic.
Dogs, cats, rabbits, ferrets.
Kuhl has medications and vaccinations for pets that need them. The clinic also helps with mental health issues.
If we can help to intervene with that human's anxiety, but at the same time make the pet's behavior easier for that human to deal with, so it's less of a stressor and trigger for their own problem, then we're going to have success from both sides.
After the veterinarian, facilitators offer people the chance to see one of the doctors or nurse practitioners on hand. And today, the county's offering routine vaccinations for people. Towards the end of the day, Justin Howard comes in with a quiet, soulful, tan and white dog who looks to be part beagle and part pit bull.
His name is Maximus Howard.
Justin Howard once had a partner and children. He lost them, he said, because he was a bad dad with drug problems.
I've lost a lot through my life. Taking care of my dog is pretty much why I get up in the morning.
Howard got a checkup. Maximus got vaccinations. Max is 11 years old, and Howard's greatest fear is that something will happen to his dog.
Honestly, I don't know where I'd be without Maximus. I don't know.
Howard says he wants people to know just how important the clinic is to him and Max. For Here and Now, I'm Joanne Silberner.
One of this week's big debunked rumors on the Snopes.com fact-checking website is the false claim that the AT&T building in Nashville was targeted with that vehicle bomb because it was auditing Dominion voting machines and would have discovered that Dominion stole votes from President Trump in the election. Not true. But a Dominion worker has gone into hiding because of such rumors and death threats against him and his family. Then there are the false COVID-19 vaccine claims, including that nurses are dropping like flies after getting the shot. Not true. We occasionally take a minute to knock back these rumors that litter the internet with Camille Knox, a researcher with the Snopes.com fact-checking site. Camille, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Robin. I appreciate it.
Well, we know you're working around the clock on this. It doesn't stop. Tons of false claims. Let's start with the healthcare workers getting the vaccine. In particular, there was a false claim about a nurse in Alabama who died. Another rumor about a nurse in Tennessee who fainted because of the vaccine. Both not true, but where'd they come from?
Going back to the Alabama nurse, the claim was basically that the woman had died after receiving a vaccination for COVID-19 and that this happened in December of this year. So we checked into that one and found out that there were no deaths related to the vaccine, which became available on December 14th. We reached out to the state of Alabama, to Alabama Department of Public Health, and they gave us a statement that said that all these Facebook posts and rumors were indeed false, and no one who received the COVID vaccine in Alabama had passed away. way. And it seems like in Tennessee, our claim was partially true, partially false. So we called this one a mostly false claim. The true part of the claim was that a Tennessee nurse whose name was Tiffany Dover had passed out after receiving the vaccine shot. The false part of it was that Dover did say that she fainted as a result of pain from the hypodermic needle shot, but not from the actual vaccine. Apparently, it turns out that she has a longstanding medical condition. So this is a case of people trying to link two things together that were actually unrelated.
Well, I tell you what, I actually fainted once live on the air on the radio years ago because of the same thing. It was the shot that had missed the vein, and it was the lovely nurse flirting with the very funny radio morning host who was there. And so, you know, that can happen, that, you know, if the needle itself gets in wrong. So nobody, no nurse has died from the vaccine or fainted because of something in the vaccine. Another false claim is going around about mRNA vaccines. These are the messenger RNA shots from Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. They send a message to the cells, so they'll produce antibodies. There's no live virus. But the false rumor is that they will alter human DNA. Tell us about the real science on this.
Yeah, so we looked into this one and found that this one was false. There was sort of this copy and pasted text that was spreading across social media, and some of the fringe conspiracy sites basically said that the COVID vaccine should be avoided at all costs. And it basically described a message from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's an anti-vaccine crusader, as we would say. It's a baseless assertion at the end of the day that basically says that mRNA vaccines produced by Pfizer and Moderna can alter your human DNA. And there's no possible way for that to happen. And we ended up getting a statement from Robert Kennedy Jr. as well, basically saying that he never made those assertions at all.
Yeah. I can remember talking to you or one of your colleagues about the false rumor going around that Bill Gates wanted people to get vaccinated because he was going to put a chip in people through the vaccine. So lots of false claims. Yep. AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine is produced differently, works differently than the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. But there's misinformation popping up about them with a false claim that AstraZeneca's vaccine contains aborted fetal cells. What work did you have to do to really get across that this is false?
Yeah, and these can be tough, Robin, when there's videos involved, because people sort of look at these and think, well, it's got to be true, it's on video, but this one's inaccurate. It's true that the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine is created by growing a modified virus in cells that are derived from what we understand to be embryonic kidney tissue. But the vaccine does not contain that cellular material, so it's actually false.
And we should say that the Vatican has issued a statement saying it is morally acceptable to receive a vaccination for COVID-19, even if the vaccine's research or production involved using cell lines derived from aborted fetuses because of the grave danger of the pandemic. So much on vaccines, and it's so important. But we do want to touch on some of the election misinformation. This could be a whole other segment, and it will. But these false claims about voting machines, you know, we know they've gotten so intense that an executive at Dominion Voting Systems had to go into hiding because of death threats. He's also now suing the Trump campaign and its allies. And mentioned in his lawsuit is Sidney Powell, the lawyer who is one of the loudest voices pushing, you know, conspiracy theories that have been debunked. They are false, having to do with Venezuela or China or Cuba somehow being involved with Dominion stealing votes from President Trump. All false. But what about that the bombing in Nashville was right outside the AT&T building there, was because AT&T was somehow involved with Dominion voting systems?
This claim we found out to be was false, that AT&T allegedly had this contract to conduct a forensic audit of Dominion voting systems in Nashville. The basis of the conspiracy theory was that the explosion was intended to destroy the machines before they were audited in order to cover up some sort of evidence of massive voter fraud. You know, by reaching out to both AT&T and Dominion, they both have told us that, you know, there was no audit and there was nothing that, you know, involved Dominion having their systems being moved to Nashville. So all of this, you know, suggests that this was another conspiracy theory that was popping up in the wake of a tragedy.
Yeah, well, and as we said, the Dominion executive is in hiding, but he's also filed this lawsuit. Dominion is now threatening legal action, and so is Smartmatic, a competitor at Dominion's. And some conservative media outlets are starting to respond. Fox News, Newsmax, having their anchors read statements, distancing themselves from these false claims or even apologizing for them. But talk about another false claim that got out there that added fuel to this fire about Joe Biden's nephew?
Yeah, so there was a theory that President-elect Joe Biden's nephew somehow owned Dominion voting systems. And so this one popped up a few weeks ago. And, you know, it sort of centers around one of the narratives in the election fraud conspiracy theory cycle that we've seen kind of pop up this year. And so this one basically tries to tie a few people together who are not related. It goes back to a meme that circulated on the internet that was tweeted out. And so there were screenshots that sort of combined two people's biographies whose last names were Owens, and come to find out, President-elect Biden's sister and his campaign manager, her last name is Owens. Her name's Valerie Biden Owens. And so we found out Valerie and her husband do not have a child whose name is Stephen Owens, which is the name that's been popping up as Biden's nephew. And so we found out that this was yet another sort of oddly placed rumor that popped up that tied together the Biden family, Biden's sister, and then Dominion voting systems.
And it's false.
It's false.
Yeah. And this started in part when a conservative activist claimed that he hacked an Antifa phone call and overheard a person referred to as Eric from Dominion assure these activists that he was not going to let Trump win. And then there were accusations that the machines themselves had clicked over the votes from Trump to Biden. It turned out to be a human error on the part of an election worker. And right. President Trump won the county handily, you know, that this claim was made about. Just as we head into the Georgia runoff election on January 5th, what other conspiracy theories are you having to knock back or keep an eye on?
There's still people who think that, depending on which source you look up for your election information, people still think that Trump won the election. And so they're sort of still holding their breath that there's going to be this sort of second coming of information that announces that Biden is not the president-elect. So there's still some of that kind of floating along. And there's still, you know, the photo of, I think it was Kelly Loeffler taking a photo with someone, I believe, who's been described as a white supremacist, that kind of, you know, got out there and that picture floated around. I think she initially said that she didn't take the picture, and we found out she did and didn't know who he was, allegedly. So those are some of the things that we're still kind of digging through. And then obviously sort of the aftermath of the explosion in Nashville and how that kind of plays out in terms of the rumors that have followed there, and whether or not that has anything to do with anything else, and the theories that the person involved may have been sort of a 5G conspiracy theorist, and you know, we're still kind of trying to figure out that part of it too.
Oh, you have your work cut out for you. Camille Knox, a researcher with the Snopes.com fact-checking website. Camille, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin. Much appreciated.
5G theorists who believe falsely that 5G cell towers cause COVID. Not true. And here's a couple more vaccine myths Camille and Snopes debunked. The false claim going around that Pfizer has a vape cartridge of the vaccine. That is not true. Nor is a claim that Nancy Pelosi staged getting the vaccine. Something about the orange cap on the needle. Snopes determined. Not true. We'll link you up. HereNow.org.
Spending for TV ads in 2020 is down about 7.5% from last year. No surprise, like much of corporate America, the industry has taken a big hit in this pandemic. And they faced creative challenges, too. For instance, how do you strike the right tone for ads during a crisis? Here and Now media analyst John Carroll joins us. And John, the year actually started off pretty normal with a marquee event of sorts for advertisers, and that's the Super Bowl.
Right. And as usual, the Super Bowl provided a number of ads that wound up on the best of list, including a Bill Murray takeoff for Jeep on Groundhog Day. And then there was the ad that really warmed the hearts of Bostonians, the Hyundai Sonata Smat Pack commercial that aired during the Super Bowl. It featured John Krasinski, Chris Evans, Rachel Dratch. Let's listen to it.
Oh, look at this guy. Hey, Rachel, how are you?
Hey, good. How are you?
He's not getting that car in there.
No, sir.
Look at these two troublemakers.
Hey, Johnny, how are you?
Wicked car. Is that new?
Yeah, it's a Sonata. Let me pack it.
Oh, you're not fitting your car in there.
Chris, stop being a smarty pants, all right? Look who's got Smart Pack.
Smart Pack?
Just hit the clicker. Car packs itself. That's smart. It's wicked.
John, I think that anyone who's even visited Boston knows why this ad was so popular, but tell us more about it.
Well, there are so many bad Boston accents out there, and they just took it over the top. The tone was perfect for the ad. One news report said that Hyundai went through 300 different scripts before they settled on this one. It was a winner.
Definitely. Then along came this wave of what you call Cove ads. How did creative teams change the tone of ads during this pandemic? We saw so many of these.
Right. In the beginning, there were these ads that had to be changed. So Geico had an ad of people high-fiving. Beer commercials had crowded bar scenes. Then this whole wave came of these very serious ads with somber voiceovers. And finally, you know, some marketers really hit the sweet spot when they figured out how to incorporate the coronavirus into ads that were actually selling something, like Burger King promoted itself as the stay home of the Whopper.
Your country needs you to stay on your couch and order in. Do your part and we'll do ours. Order through the Burger King app and the delivery fees are on us. So staying home doesn't just make us all safer. It makes you a couch patriot.
So it's interesting, the footage for the ad was shot for a completely different project. This was a situation where they repurposed it, and there was a lot of sort of agility and creativity that the coronavirus brought out in the ad business.
Mm-hmm. One of the best examples of agility and creativity was this work produced by the Lincoln Project, a group of never-Trump Republican strategists.
Right. The Lincoln Project is a conservative super PAC. Probably the biggest ad that they did was one that was a takeoff on Ronald Reagan's classic 1984 Morning in America ad, except they added a U to the morning.
There's morning in America. Today, more than 60,000 Americans have died from a deadly virus Donald Trump ignored. With the economy in shambles, more than 26 million Americans are out of work, the worst economy in decades. Trump bailed out Wall Street, but not Main Street.
So that ad ran in May, so those numbers are outdated. But basically, it made a big impact. It raised a lot of money for the Lincoln Project, too. They raised $87 million over the course of this election cycle. Critics say a lot of that was sort of ill-used.
Another controversial campaign that wound up on the best of 2020 lists was Nike's You Can't Stop Us series. I remember this. One TV spot features a split screen footage of two amateur athletes, as well as black people and white people and Muslim people and Asians.
We're never alone. And that is our strength. Because when we're doubted, we'll play as one. When we're held back, we'll go farther and harder.
Many critics have said that this ad uses diversity very well and is really visually appealing. What do you think, John?
Visually, it's stunning. I mean, they went through about 4,000 sports clips. And what they did with the split screen was they married two clips together that seemed to be one. The problem here is that on social media, there was a lot of criticism because of news reports about them using Uyghur forced labor in Chinese factories. But, you know, best of lists very often leave context out and just look at the creative work itself.
What a year. Many advertisers reflecting the society in which we live and the issues that we're all dealing with. John, Carol, thank you so much. John is Here and Now's media analyst. Have a happy new year.
You too, Tanya. Thanks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
The killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Breonna Taylor in Louisville by police prompted protests and calls for change across the U.S. this year. The year in policing. That's next time on Here and Now.